Hello and welcome to Weekly Monotony, the official podcast of the entertainment blog DailyMonotony.com. And now, the news.
I'm, of course, Dustin Anglin, your host, and as you will notice by my very, very poor Walter Cronkite impression, this week we're just doing a straight-up news segment. We're not actually reviewing a movie, simply because there was no movie out last weekend that any of us wanted to see. So, we're bringing you some of the juicier tidbits from the news world of both games and movies, and joining me again is our, I guess, guest star, but now almost regular star, Todd Anglin from TellericWatch.com. Welcome, Todd.
And since it seems that this show is built on having some sort of catchphrase,
let's hear this.
If I'm going to keep coming back, I'm going to have to keep working on this. I'd come up with a clever one this week, but it's just not worth introducing. This is a new segment. I'll save it for next time I'm back.
We will wait with bated breath for your amazing entrance.
That really is not necessary. I would encourage you not to bait your breath for this. It's not worth it.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and jump into things. As usual, we always talk a little bit about the media we've been consuming in this past week, sort of how we spend our time enjoying the world of entertainment. Todd, why don't you go ahead and start us off with any entertainment you've been enjoying this past week?
Entertainment of the past week. Well, I do have a little bit of offbeat TV news that we can toss in here, and then perhaps a little bit of gaming news, and we can perhaps build on that as we go. First, a TV show that just wrapped this week, a series that wrapped. It kind of started late in the fall, maybe early summer, and ran. Actually, I do think it started late spring, and just ran until this past Saturday. And that was a sort of pseudo horror series called Harper's Island. Did you see the show or hear of the show?
I've heard of it, but we've had problems with our television provider, so I'm afraid I've not gotten the chance to see it.
Well, you know, you didn't miss much. I'll put that much out there. But this was an interesting series because it ran on CBS. It was a weekly serial TV show, and it was promoted early on as being this very unique horror film made for TV. Week by week, at least one person would die. In fact, the catchphrase for the show was one by one, as in one by one, each of the characters will die. So it painted this very interesting story of every week somebody's going to die, and you, the audience, is not going to know who the killer is. And so part of the show's intrigue was trying to sort of null through the, null through the opaque story and try to figure out who's the real killer here. Who are they trying to really make the bad guy? And there was this very elaborate plot about a serial killer in the island and all the stuff that came together to make up the show. And it was interesting. It started out kind of promising. You know, it had an interesting beginning, had an interesting premise, especially with the mystery built into it. It very quickly became clear that the show was not afraid to be gory, especially by TV standards. Sure. I mean, the very first guy that got killed, I think, got killed by having his entire lower torso cut off.
I believe that would be called disemboweling.
So, for a TV series, I think push some boundaries on in terms of what kind of gore is acceptable for what is really broadcast TV. I mean, this was on CBS. In fact, so much to the point where the show was on weeknights and then it stopped for a few weeks and everybody thought the show got canceled. I mean, this is one of those classic things where the forums lit up and people online got all upset that they thought the show had been pulled because the network couldn't handle the, I assume, feedback complaints. Sure. But then it reappeared on Saturday nights and ran through the end of the series. And by the end of it, again, it just ended this week. I won't provide spoilers if some of you have DVR'd this and are still planning to watch it. I'll say that if I had to rank it 1 to 10, it was probably a 5 or 6, in the sense that it had a lot of good mystery. It had a lot of interesting gore for TV, but it was still your sort of B-minus horror flick just stretched out over a number of weeks in TV serial format. And the reveal at the end about who is the killer was really kind of awkwardly done, almost a little anticlimactic, almost a little unbelievable.
Sure.
It certainly wasn't, at least for me, predictable, but almost too unpredictable. A little bit like, you'd never pick this guy, so that's who it is in terms of being the killer. So anybody who didn't watch it or who's DVR'd it, I would encourage you to finish out the season, watch it. I thought it was at least mildly entertaining, but if you missed it, I'd save this for plane rides when you have nowhere else to be. Maybe one of those shows worth catching
You're
up
stuck
on.
Stuck with a lot of people you don't like and don't want to talk to anyone else.
You just show them your little iPhone screen of gore. You're like, yeah, this is what I'm watching. back up.
Well, I admit the premise sounds interesting, at least sort of a drawn out whodunit mystery, though. Though, yeah. I mean, I'm sure, I guess it was appealing towards the fan of the sort of the torture porn, gore fest, horror crowd.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it kind of walked that
which,
line.
Which is weird for TV, because TV is definitely more highly censored than film ever is. So right. It's kind of odd to see the mixing of that genre. Maybe that's why it didn't quite fly as well. I mean, yeah. Moving it to a Saturday slot was...
I don't know if maybe the directors got maybe reeled back, or the editors got reeled back maybe after early on, where people did say this is a little too much
for
TV.
Saturday night is clearly... Sure. They moved it there because they were getting complaints. Because, I mean, Saturday night you can show a lot more than you can show on a mainstream, I guess, primetime weekday night. So...
Right, and it definitely didn't, the gore didn't let up, so I guess I'd have to agree with you there. I mean, there's plenty of stabbing and beheading and all these other kind of gruesome, like, torture plots. Not necessarily torture, but at least booby trap
sure.
death plots. So, you know, if you're into that kind of thing, that's not my favorite kind of movie or TV
right.
show. I'll be very clear there. I'm not, I don't even like the Saw movies, but it doesn't get that bad. So if you're mildly interested in that kind of format, maybe it's a show worth checking out. Otherwise, that's sort of my TV news. There's not really much other TV news to share now. There's some other summer popcorn shows that have sort of spun up that are not worth mentioning, so
right.
it's best to push on to gaming. I have been playing games. Now, the last few weeks I've been on, I've said, no time for gaming, but I've actually found time to play a couple of games. And they're casual games.
That's always good.
But they've been really fun, and so I'll bring them up in order. First of all, on 4th of July... We went really early to get a good spot to watch fireworks here locally. Had the iPhone. I was like, you know, I need something to play. And the games I had were kind of old. I wasn't that interested.
Sure.
So I went searching and found a game called Flight Control for the iPhone. Have you
yes.
heard of this game?
Oh, yes. I've actually been playing it for a while now. And go ahead and explain what Flight Control is.
So the basic premise of Flight Control is you have your iPhone. And you have a run. You're basically simulating air traffic control in a very simplified form. You have a screen that has a runway, and the runway has three different landing pads, essentially one for large planes, one for small planes, and one for helicopters. And as the level progresses, different planes of different sizes and helicopters come flying in from the edges, and it's your job to use your finger to draw the path that plane will take and direct it to its proper runway. And as the level progresses, more planes come. The more challenging it becomes to direct them without crashing, and if planes do crash, then it's game over. So you basically have to land as many planes as you can before two collide.
Right. It's very much in arcade style, so it's difficulty slowly ramps up to a point where you're guaranteed to fail, and it's all about getting the high score, getting to the longest lasting point, I guess.
Exactly. So what did you think of this game? You've been playing it for a while.
It's actually interesting. I think this is probably one of the first games I actually ever played more than once. So I definitely picked up a lot of iPhone games just as they became more prevalent and gave them a try. But most of them I'd play once and be like, okay, I kind of get it. It's okay. And then I'd drop it. But Flight Control is one I guess it was one of the first of the few iPhone games I played where the controls just made perfect sense and seemed to map to the iPhone almost exactly perfectly. I mean, the fact that you click on a plane as it comes in and you draw a path for it to how it's supposed to land into its one of its runways. And I think that works perfectly for the iPhone. Like, it's quick, it's responsive. You never feel like you're missing something, or you never feel like the dexterity you have with your fat fingers is not good enough to play the game. And that's something that really connected with me. My only problem with this is it's a type of game that I don't generally enjoy as much, which is an arcade game, in that it ramps up in this sort of difficulty thing, and all of it is about this challenge of sort of pushing yourself further and further. And I think when I played this game the first time, I actually did pretty well, and I got to like 35 planes landed or something like that on my first try, and then for the next 10 tries I couldn't get past like 21 or 22. And like it's all arcade games get to that level where you do really well, and then you're just trying to beat yourself, and it just becomes almost a lesson in frustration unless you just have one of those excellent games, which is really exciting and makes you want to play more. But unless you get from, I guess, the sort of tent poles of excitement where you do well between the sort of, like, you know, the troughs of just, like, despair and discouragement, I find it really hard to come back to and play those games often. But it is definitely something every once in a while, once I've forgotten like how discouraging the last time I played the game was, I'll come back to it and I'll play it again and see if I can't beat my high score.
Yeah, I'll echo that. I mean, this is I've bought a number of games for the iPhone, maybe not as many as you have, I'm not sure, but I've bought a handful over time. I'm not afraid to spend money to buy a game that looks interesting. But this is definitely one of the few games that I've actually still come back to several days or even now a few weeks after I've originally purchased it and continued to play and trying to improve upon my score. And that's I found to be a little bit unique, and I have to give them credit for making a game that's addictive enough and simple enough to come back to and do that, because very few games for me have held that kind of interest where I'm willing to reopen it up a few weeks later. But it is that you've described exactly what motivates you to play the game, is that you play it, you get a score, and you think, I can better than 35. Right. So you put it down for a couple days, and you're sitting somewhere, you have a little time, you pull it out, like, okay, I can beat 35. I am better than 35 right. planes. And you start, swooping them around. And I agree, the interface is very elegant. I absolutely love the controls of the game. It's probably one of the best implementations of touch in an iPhone game I found, because that line that you draw for the planes to land is so perfectly matched to your movements.
No, I agree. And it doesn't feel like really there's any lag or any sort of calculation time. It's just it's fast and fluid.
It's just that's the movement.
And that's what you want in a portable handheld game. You don't want to feel like the phone is trying to catch up to what you're doing.
Right. So what's your high score?
I think my high score on now they have multiple maps now, and
I think there's three maps total, and that's actually one of my complaints. Is I've played all three maps, and I want more. I want more variety.
When I started out playing this game, there's just one map, and that was, I guess, the original map it comes with. And I think my high score in that is 48.
Okay.
And that's about as good as I've done. At that point, things just become so hectic that I'm just like, so.
That's around where I peaked for the longest time. And I think maybe yesterday, I think on the, for anybody who wants to try the game out, the Aloha map, which I think is the one of the extra maps there, the Hawaiian map, I think I managed to get 76 planes.
Wow. I played that Aloha map over this past weekend for the first time. I finally updated my game. And I think on my first try, I got up to 40 something. So I think that map may be a little bit easier. Just because there are no, so like the way it works is you have like each plane and each different runway they go to almost directly varies with the speed of the plane. And in the first map, like you have basically a fast plane, a slower plane, and a really slow plane. And then as it gets more difficult, you get like the super fast plane that's really big too. And I feel like the Aloha map never quite got to the point where I started getting the super fast planes coming at the regularity as I did with the other ones.
Yeah. No, they do start coming.
I'd say the air.
The score is sort of irrelevant. Sure. As much as it is the way that difficulty ramps up, and I do wish if I was going to keep playing this game, I do wish there'd be more levels. That's my one complaint. Is now that I've kind of, in my own opinion, maxed out my abilities on each of these levels, I need more levels to feel confident I can do better
on. And it seems like that's what they're planning on doing. It seems like they're sort of releasing new maps as they go. I think they actually released a multiplayer component to this, though.
I did read that.
The most recent version that I updated to did not have the component, so I was a little confused there.
The version I think I downloaded does have that, and supposedly if your friend has the game as well, I'm not sure. I'm almost certain that you have to be on Wi-Fi. I don't think it works over 3G.
I think it actually works over Bluetooth, but me and a friend tried to get it working over this past weekend, but his had the multiplayer thing. I updated my game, and it didn't have multiplayer, so we weren't quite sure what happened.
Odd.
But here's
either way, when it's there, I think what you're supposed to be able to do is essentially flick planes or use your finger to drag planes off your screen and basically send them to your opponents,
right. No.
Making their game more hectic.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, that sounds like fun. I'd like to get that going, but I think I guess one of the big top selling points of this is that the game, at least when I bought it, was only 99 cents, and basically a dollar is throwaway money, and for that, for the experience you get, like there's no reason if you have an iPhone and you want to have sort of even a small amount of diverting time to not buy this game. I highly recommend it. So.
Yeah, can't agree more. Even with the small amount of levels, definitely worth the dollar. Can't lose for
you
a dollar.
You can't lose for a dollar. Yeah.
The other game I've been playing, also kind of casual, is one that came out very recently. It almost hit me by surprise. I didn't really realize it was coming, though I'm sure if you've been following gaming news closely, you were well aware of it, but it caught me a little off guard, and that is Battlefield 1943 for Xbox Live Arcade. Now, I know you were, and I know I certainly was, a big fan of Battlefield 1942.
Oh, yeah.
from apparently the year previous, back for the PC days, and specifically the Wakefield Island ship for Battlefield 1942, which those of you who maybe are familiar with the Battlefield series, that demo was really what kicked off the Battlefield franchise before Battlefield 2 or any of the other games we may be familiar with today. And the demo was so successful that I think that they actually had a challenge at the time of convincing people to upgrade from the demo and buy the real game. I mean, people were content to play the demo over and over.
You and me probably played the Wake Island demo of that game for months and months before we actually went and ponied up and bought a real copy of the game.
And even then, I think we still liked the Wake Island demo.
We went in and we played Wake Island over and over just because none of the other levels came close to as good as Wake Island was.
So DICE, the original creators of the game, Digital Interactive something or other, I think, I don't know their full name. DICE is the abbreviation.
I think they're a French or Canadian company.
And then I guess publisher EA have kind of updated a little bit and then re-released this game now. It's essentially the same demo that was released for PC for Xbox Live Arcade. Yep. It's about 1,200 Microsoft points, so whatever that converts out to dollars.
$15.
So basically, pretty cheap. It's not the price of a full game, I guess, should be the point there. Though I guess the reverse of that is you are paying money for what was kind of like the demo for the PC game a few years ago, albeit with maybe a better online experience.
Yep.
But the game is centered around the Wakefield Island maps, again, pulled over from the old PC demo. And I'm going to kick it to you and get your opinion, because apparently you've been playing it. What do you think of this 1943 reinvention?
So it's interesting. So 1943 is it's meant to be a casual first-person online shooter. And it really does take what the original 1942 did and kind of bring it up to speed with more modern, I guess, first-person shooters to an extent. It builds on the same engine they use for the Battlefield Bad Company demo, which if you play the game, you'll actually notice that a lot of the buildings are now mostly destructible, so you can now shoot through walls, you can run over stuff, you're no longer stopped by a tree if you're in a tank, which is always nice.
I did like that. That was really nice, yeah.
But yeah, basically...
Helps when you're a bad driver.
Yeah, it does. But I mean, the amazing thing, this really is repackaging what they sold people back with Battlefield 1942 with a little bit of a technical and graphical upgrade. But I don't know, to me, like, picking up this game, and I actually downloaded the demo for the PS3, and that's what I've been playing it for, it's just brought all of those wonderful fun memories of why I was addicted to the original Wake Island demo for the PC so many years back. Like, I remembered why I loved it so much. It was just so much fun. It's like jumping into it, like all those things, all these sort of paths I used to take running around the island, all these strategies I used to use playing that just kind of came back to me, flooding back to me. And it was amazing that how well they still worked in this era. In fact, it was almost humorous that, like, as soon as I started playing the game and kind of figured out some of the base mechanics, I would quickly jump up to be like one of the top players in that round simply because I remember exactly the same things that happened in 1942, which is if you go for the flags, you go for the objectives, you do well in this game. And it was almost funny. It's like I feel like an old man, like, coming back to a game that young people are now just finding out. I'm like, oh, you young people, you don't yet know how to play this game. Let me show you how it's played.
You raise a really interesting point, and I agree completely. So one of the things I noticed early on when playing this is exactly that, is that I felt like I was an expert at the game when I jumped in. Yep. Now, again, it's because I played 1942, I understood the strategy early on, and for those of you who did not play Battlefield 1942, the layout is essentially the game type essentially capture the flag, where it is respawn infinitely. But it's teams that hold the most flags, get the most points. The goal is to basically, you know, drain
a bunch of objective points around the map that you have to capture. And if you have a majority of them captured, the other team's score goes down. And basically, Battlefield pioneered that concept of sort of the objective capture the base gameplay.
Right. And if you played Call of Duty 4, there's a game mode in there that's very similar. So we're all pretty familiar, I would imagine, with the Capture the Flag gameplay by now. But this is really the game that pioneered it, so it's kind of going back to the roots. But I was amazed at how advanced I felt in the game. Like, I literally felt like I was playing with a bunch of kindergartners, a bunch of people that were, like, brand new to the idea of even gaming, let alone the first-person shooter. I mean, I literally remember getting into tanks and being the gunner, and the driver was like, taking long routes, not, you know, yep. driving around. It's like, what? I mean, I'm a bad driver. I'm not even a great first-person shooter, but I felt like I was whipping up on these games, and I was like, okay, the strategy at this point is we need to jump to the other yep. side of the island, you know, flank yep. them, take the flag, work back towards the center, and nobody got that. I was literally like the lone guy yep. running the actual things you do. So what I wondered is because I played Call of Duty 4, and I'm a huge fan of Call of Duty 4, and I quickly got outranked by the people that were actually experts at these types of games in Call of Duty 4, are these people just not yet making the sure to play Battlefield, or are these people there and the game type is different enough that I actually feel good again?
Yeah, it's almost bizarre, right? It's almost like we've come full circle, right? Like, we started, like, I think probably one of the earliest, I guess, online multiplayer games that we ever played was probably this game and maybe the Castle Return to Castle Wolfenstein demo. Like, I remember specifically True, those yeah. things being my initiation into online first-person shooters, and it's so weird that we've now come back full circle and now, like, we feel old pros at this, even though I would admit with you, I feel very intimidated going on Call of Duty or Halo at this point, simply because everyone feels so good at that sort of skill shooting genre. But here we're getting back to the almost pure objective, the multi-vehicle concept, and I do feel a bit like, you know, this uber-powered person as I've come in with all the keys, all the knowledge. And now I agree. I think I tweeted actually this that I took a game back. It was like three of us versus eight of the other people. You know, we lost a bunch of our team, and I and these two other people managed to bring that back from sort of the edge of destruction, and we won that game even though there were only three of us. Simply because wow. I knew how to play the game. Like, I would do the thing. I'd grab a base on one side, run over to the other side, grab that base. Like, all the other team would go, like, shuffling over there exactly as I knew they would. And it was, I mean, it was immensely fun. And I have to say, for a $15 purchase on either PSN or on the Xbox Live Arcade, this is a steal and so immensely fun. Even if it only really is 1942 repackaged. Like, I really don't feel it's expanded on that concept too much, but it's right. still immensely
so a
fun.
A few final wrap-up points on this game, because I think this game is actually almost as good as a full release, even though it is just an Xbox Live Arcade release. First of all, there is a demo, so if you want to play the Wake Island. I'm pulling out from the TV series we just talked about. If you want to play the Wake Island demo, there is a demo you can download. However, EA... lesson, and the demo, at least on Xbox now, is limited to 30 minutes.
Yep.
So you get 30 minutes of gameplay, and then they say, you know, we learned with 1942, if you want to keep playing, you pay up. So there is a fee to pay once you get past that, and like Dustin just said, it's about $15. Now, the other thing I'll say is that if you're on Xbox Live Arcade, a second level has been added. I've not yet played it, but I believe a level called Coral Sea yep. has just been added because Xbox Live Arcade people have killed more than PS3 people. Take that, sucka. So we get an extra level. And I assume and I hope that EA will continue to release additional levels perhaps for this as time marches on.
I believe that is their goal, is to eventually release more maps and make this very much a incremental purchase concept where you're kind of, as you want more things, you buy what you want, which is actually, I think, a nice way to do it, because if it were up to me, I would have, with the original 1942, I would have bought just Wake Island and only played that. So, no, is this...
Right, absolutely.
Is this new
and
map...
So,
do you have to buy it, or is it for free?
If I understand correctly, and I have not fired up my Xbox today to confirm, I believe it is free for Xbox Live Arcade.
Interesting.
People who purchased the game. So if you not the demo, but if you purchased the actual Xbox Live Arcade game, the game map should be unlocked for you for free. So check that out. I'm almost certain that's the case. The final thing I'll add to this is there's been a few Battlefield reincarnations for Xbox up to this point. I think a few years ago there was one that was kind of made for Xbox, kind of failed in my opinion. I think they maybe even tried an additional. Well, there was a Bad Company, which was a big step forward.
Yeah, there was. So originally there was a Battlefield 2 Modern Combat, and that was sort of a takeoff in the Battlefield 2 series, and that was, I think, widely regarded as a big miss by DICE. And then Battlefield Bad Company came out a while back, and I actually played that demo for a while and found it to be quite entertaining.
Did you ever play the game?
I never bought the full game, simply because I had my fill with the demo again, and had a fun time playing that yeah. over and over, and past that point, I'd moved on to something else. But
sure. So I will say that for me, at least, and I played the Battlefield Bad Company, I played Battlefield Modern Combat on Xbox, and of course, I was a big fan of Battlefield 2 and the original Battlefield on PC. So big Battlefield fan. I think that's probably why I'm a fan of Call of Duty 4. This, for me, is by far, by miles, the best Battlefield experience for a console, at least the Xbox, that I've played to date. And it totally returns, for me, the enjoyment of the Battlefield franchise to the console, because it kind of lost it there for me for the last two revisions. But if they can tweak a few things, I mean, there's a few things in the controls that I kind of missed from Call of Duty, but other than that, this is right up there on the Call of Duty level, even as an arcade game, and I would say this is worth every penny of $15, and if they added more levels, this would be worth every penny of a full-on game.
It's kind of funny. It feels like this was how the original Battlefield 1942 should have been released. Because the original Battlefield 1942 did not have a single-player campaign that you could play through. It did not have a story. It was basically just an online multiplayer experience. And this, now that we've gone into this world of downloadable content and episodic content and, you know, microtransactions, I feel like we've finally reached that era where it made sense for 1942 to exist. And I feel like that's what they've done with 1943, is just kind of reinvigorate or sort of reincarnate the original 1942 into this medium. And I hope it does well, because it definitely is. It's as fun as I remember the original game being.
So I've chewed up a lot of time here as the guest guest star, as you so generously bestowed me. But I have one final piece, and then we'll talk movie news, if you will indulge me. I got an urge this weekend to play Myst, and I think it's probably because the Myst games are now, or the original Myst is now available for the iPhone as well. So they've actually ported that game, Cyan Worlds or Kyan Worlds, however you want to
say. I think Cyan.
The original maker of Myst has actually created a version of the game for iPhone. So pretty cool thing there. So I was like, well, you know, I really want to play this, but I'm really not sure if I want to play it on the iPhone. I don't know if I want to hold the phone and play it, you know, if I can be at a PC and play it. So it got me looking into it, and I started searching, and I've got a new Mac here, so I was hoping I could find a version for Mac, and it turns out they never updated the game for Mac. So I was, you know, I was getting all tied up in trying to actually find a game for PC, which, for those of you who don't know me well, I've kind of moved on, in a sense, from PC gaming. For a long time, I held on to it, especially with Battlefield 2, but the Xbox serves my gaming needs, at least, well enough that I tend to not play many games on the PC. But Myst, I knew, was one I'd need on the PC. So I searched and searched, and there just weren't a lot of good options. And while doing that, I was kind of looking at what existed, what had been updated since my time playing Myst and Riven and all the more original entries into the series. And I was a little surprised that it kind of died, so more or less, in 2002, 2003. There really hasn't been a major update. There's Uru Live, you know, that's kind of its own thing, and even that kind of shut down, and I think maybe it came back. And when it moved to that 3D engine where they stopped doing these really nice painted scenes and they moved to this sort of 3D rendered, for me that kind of lost some of the magic of the game, where the real beauty was the intricate detail that you can't do in real-time 3D. Yep. So I was left at the end of the weekend longing for a better Myst experience, and that kind of set the wheels turning, and it got me to this point of saying, wouldn't it be cool if Ubisoft, which is the publisher for Myst now, and Cyan Worlds, is that how you said it's pronounced?
Cyan, I think, but I could be Cyan, I could be wrong. I don't know.
The color,
like the
Cyan,
color Cyan, I don't know.
Yeah. Who makes Myst? Wouldn't it be cool if they made a version of Myst? I would be even happy with a port of the original for Xbox 360 with Project Natal. Because the original, I know they've done a Myst for Xbox in the past, and it more or less kind of failed for people, because people didn't like the translation of going to a thumbstick to do all the grab and maneuvering of that, the point and click maneuvering that Myst requires. Yep. But imagine the Myst experience with Project Natal, with the ability to actually use your own hands, which Myst has always tried to simulate with their little hand icons to play the game. Yep. I mean, to me, that is the coolest thing that could come out for Xbox with Natal, and I would pay boatloads of money for it.
Now, I have to admit, when you sent me that the idea for that concept, it just clicked perfectly with me. I think that would be one of the most amazing things you could do with the Natal platform, because it really is. I mean, you'd have the same interface of I'm looking around in this, you know, beautiful painted environment like we got in the Myst series up through the fourth iteration until they got into, I think, Myst 5, which was the first fully 3D. If you don't count Uru in there. But no, I agree. It just would work so amazingly well. Like I'm a junkie for the Myst games. I've played through Myst 1 through 4 countless number of times and enjoy them every time I go through it. I actually thought they had come to a point with the fourth iteration of Myst where they'd kind of done this thing where there was a bit more interactivity with what you were looking at, even though it was still these beautifully rendered, painted environments that you were looking at. So, but yeah, being able to actually sort of, you know, I imagine you take your hand and you put it in the center and you kind of use that to move your viewpoint around, and then you see something like a lever and you just grab out with it and you can literally grasp onto it and change it, or you can press a button using the dexterity of your fingers or a little shadow of your hand being displayed over the environment. I think that would be amazing.
I mean, it's what Myst always wanted to be. Myst always wanted you to be immersed in these worlds where you were first person perceiving as if you were in the Myst worlds. I mean, that's the reason they always had that hand icon instead of the standard cursor. It's the reason they always had this very first person point of view. So to me, the Natal is a perfect marriage with Myst, and I hope Ubisoft, anybody from Ubisoft, anybody from Microsoft who ends up listening to this or finds this archived audio, please make a version of Myst for Project Natal. I would pay double a normal game price, as would I imagine many other Myst fans, to play that game with the Natal interface.
So
I hope that comes around.
So here's the interesting thing is, as much as I think you and I love that Myst adventure experience, I almost am afraid that even with the, I think, if the fair number of Myst fans out there who remember the game fondly, I'm not quite sure whether it's the market anymore for a game like that. And as cool as it sounds to even remake the original Myst or one of the later Myst series in an Natal environment, I'm almost afraid it wouldn't sell, simply because I think people have moved past the sort of the complex, challenging puzzle experience that Myst offered. And
I will disagree for a very, very specific reason, and you're welcome to disagree back. I was interested in the game. I wanted to play it. Can't buy the game online, obviously. It's a little too old for that. So I was like, well, just take a chance and see if it's still on store shelves. Now, mind you, the original Myst was made in 1993.
First game on CD.
First game on CD, and they released a sort of 10th anniversary version in 2003, which, for those of you who are bad at math, that's about 6 years ago. I was able to go to Best Buy and find Myst, the 10th anniversary edition, on the shelf, on the game store shelf, still, with all the other new games, and I think there are very few games out there that can claim that ability to actually be on retail shelves 6 years, and if we count the fact that these games are made longer than that, even up to... what is it? We're getting close to, now I'm the bad math person, 16 years after the games originally made. I mean, how many games have that kind of staying power? So, I mean, maybe the major market's moved on, but I think this game has demonstrated its ability to continue to sell copies years and years after the tech passed it up. I would think people may be reinterested in the series if they did a good update.
And I agree with you on that. But that's mostly because I think the original Myst has the same je ne sais quoi as, like, the original Mario games, or any game that's held as a key game in its market. And Myst used to be the highest selling game of all time until The Sims was created. But that's, I just think, something special about the original Myst. I mean, if you look at the later iterations, which I actually think some of the better Myst games are the third iteration, Myst Exile, and the fourth one, which I believe is Myst Revelation, if I'm remembering it correctly.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And I actually think...
Well, let me see. I've got the 10th anniversary box right here in front of me, so,
well, so I
will confirm while you
talk. I actually
talk.
Believe those later two, or those, I guess, three and four, were actually far superior to what was done in the original Myst, or even in Riven. But, you know, interest sort of waned off after a while, because people did, of course, love the original Myst back when it came out, when there was barely anything that you could play on your computer, and a adventure game like Myst was very easy to show and very, very unique to play. But I think as time's gone on, if you look at that genre specifically, you would find that there are very few games that continue to make new content in that genre. There was a series, I believe, called the Journeyman Chronicles, which made several iterations, but very few people actually played. And I do feel it almost in some way is a niche field. Like, here at Microsoft, I'm in this sort of this interesting puzzle subculture we have at Microsoft, where we do these puzzle events and we solve a lot of these interesting complex puzzles and do these kind of story-based puzzle events. But even that is, I think, a very small subculture for the general populace. And I would imagine that Ubisoft would be wary to release a new title using the missed concepts, that sort of looking around the world, clicking on stuff, writing down stuff, and having to solve hard puzzles in this day and age. And I'm being, you know, overly pessimistic with our current gaming generation, but I would be afraid that would be a hard sell to any Ubisoft exec.
Cyan Worlds, Ubisoft, I and all the people my age and older that played Myst in the original days, we will pay you double for this game. Make this game for Natal.
I will definitely, even with my pessimism, I would stand by you there. I would be the first person in line to buy a new Myst game coming out for Natal.
So that's about all the major stuff I've actually played. I actually have other news. We'll save that for the end. But I think we should talk a little bit about your movie news, because I'm really interested to hear what you've got
there. Let's jump in a little bit to what we've got going on in movies. First, I want to mention, I did watch a couple of movies, but I'm just going to mention the big one I was incredibly excited to see. And this is Catherine Bigelow's The Hurt Locker. It's an independent film about an explosive ordnance disposal squad in the Iraq War in 2004. So this is a fictional piece, but set in you know, the real conflict back in 2004. And it's really set up as, even as not being a political piece, not being something like In the Valley of Allah or something like Stop Loss or any of these other many, you know, pedantic political pieces that we've had plenty of for the Iraq War. It's almost sort of, I think, walks in the footsteps of movies like The Kingdom, Three Kings, which were, let's take the Iraq War setting and let's do this cool fictional story based in that setting. And Catherine Bigelow does an amazing job of just making this high-intensity, action-packed thriller movie set in the Iraq War without being so crazy that you feel like it's going away or being disrespectful to what's going on there. She actually manages to do it in a way that makes you, I think, appreciate more than I've ever appreciated the perils of fighting the Iraq War, when you're fighting against one or two insurgents in a crowd of innocent civilians in this really perilous urban environment. And it's kind of interesting, you know, we talked a lot last week about Public Enemies and about how, you know, it was maybe interesting from an intellectual level, but maybe not so much on the entertaining side, at least if you're Todd or Scott, I found it entertaining.
Trust us.
But this movie, it was just, you know, balls to the wall, absolutely entertaining, and I was very surprised to get that from an independent film, because this is clearly an independent film. But yeah, it's
interesting.
I could go on for hours about how good this film was, but I'll try to keep it down.
Fortunately for audience, we have.
I will try to keep it down to some of just the really cool things I loved about this. One of the cool ways, this was also shot in a very handheld perspective, so you basically have a lot of these kind of shaky handheld shots. But in this case, it just really does lead into the realism of this environment, into the Iraq War, especially the fact that many of these handheld shots are shown of like a handheld coming through a doorway and looking out over a balcony. So you almost feel some of these handhelds could be an insurgent or a terrorist, you know, holding the detonator to this bomb that this character is about, you know, trying to disarm. And it really does just add perfectly to this intense sense of, you know, suspense of, is this guy going to get this bomb, you know, basically disarmed in time? And even though the movie is really just that concept, a guy going up to this bomb and trying to disarm it multiple times, they somehow managed to make it seem more exciting each time and slightly different enough each time that you don't feel like you're just watching the same set piece over and over.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I could recommend this to just about absolutely anyone, especially, you know, if you love great action movies, high adrenaline action movies. This is the perfect film, and it's, you know, it's an independent film. How does something like that happen? This would be a far superior.
Yeah, it's unusual. For
be
sure.
A far superior film than seeing Transformers, or I would say any of the other summer action films we've had thus far. Maybe putting Star Trek out to another side, simply because it's almost feels like a completely different genre. But
very interesting.
Yeah, Hurt Locker, if it...
I read that Colin Farrell and Charlize Theron were originally set to star in this movie, so it originally sounds like it was supposed to be a bigger movie, maybe.
It could be. And so Catherine Bigelow has done some... She's definitely done big-budget films before. I believe she got her start doing Point Break back in the 80s. She did K-19, The Widowmaker, and those were all, you know, wide-release, big-budget films. But, yeah, this stars, I think, Jeremy Renner as sort of the main bomb squad disposal guy, and he basically plays a character who's addicted to the adrenaline rush of disarming bombs and almost addicted to the adrenaline rush of war, which we kind of learn as we get through sort of the later story elements. But yeah, it's just, you know, from beginning to end, I found this to be, you know, edge of my seat, exciting, thrilling, without being stupid. You know, it actually manages to say something with it, though it's something about the Iraq War without being overtly political to one side or the other. So, yeah, to me, this was a pretty perfect movie down most of the way. Sure, there are some problems with it, and maybe if Todd, if you ever get a chance to see it later, we can go into that deeper. But
I think it will. I mean, you get given a positive review of it. I'm interested in the topic. I'm always interested in action-packed movies, and I definitely this is not a movie I would have found on my own, it being independent. Yep. But The Hurt Locker looks very interesting. It's 2008, so not too far back there. I think we'll definitely see if we can find this one on demand.
Yeah, this is something, you know, as soon as it comes out to rent, you should see it. If you can get your theater to pick it up, go and demand they bring The Hurt Locker in. It's a great film.
Cool.
So that's what I watched, but let's get into some of the interesting news items we have coming up. My first of which is Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, as when I wrote the article for DailyMonotony.com last night, was at 98% on the tomato meter.
98%?
Basically almost perfect.
What? More than Star Trek and Dark Knight?
But I'm actually pulling up Rotten Tomatoes right now to see if it's come down now that more reviews come out. I see it's now down to 95%, but that is still, hands down, far more than any other Harry Potter film has ever been. I believe one of the films that's widely regarded to be the best of this Harry Potter series was Alfonso Cuarón's The Prisoner of Azkaban, and that, I believe, got an 89% in the end. But this movie, it just seems to be getting universal applause and praise from every reviewer.
So, that is shocking.
So my question, and I posed this in my article on DailyMonotony.com, which you can read, is this going to be the new best Potter film? And going on to that point, what have you thought of the Harry Potter series so far? Todd, what have you thought of the Harry Potter series so far? Have you seen...
Well, since I'm the only person you can kick it to, I'm happy to...
Have you seen all of them so far?
No, I have not, and that's actually interesting. I watched the first, I think, and I always get confused because they start to run together for me. I think I've seen the first two, maybe three, and if I've seen the third one, it may be a little blurry. So let me review. I saw the first one. I don't think the first one had a special name, right?
The first Sorcerer's
Stone?
The first one was the Sorcerer's Stone, yes.
Right, and I saw one with the whatever that had the Phoenix in the name. What one was that?
That was actually the last one, Order of the Phoenix, number 5.
Oh, maybe I didn't see that one. Either way, I've only seen a couple, and the rest I've seen as they kind of come out on TV in bits and pieces. So they all start to run together for me. But the point from my standpoint was I saw them early on. There's a lot of excitement around Harry Potter. You know, sort of like the summer blockbusters of the time.
Yeah.
So my wife actually, she's read all the books, so she was a big fan of the series. So we'd go see the movies. But then even she, you know, she being a fan of the books, we stopped going to see the movies. I mean, it's kind of like, oh, it's another Harry Potter movie.
Yep.
Oh, you know, okay, whatever. You know, oh, a little magic, blah, blah,
yep.
blah. You know, Harry Potter wins at the end of the
yep.
day. So I really genuinely lost my entire interest in this series until about 30 seconds ago when you said that this got a 95% on Rotten Tomatoes, which I generally respect as being a relatively accurate barometer of at least a terrible movie from a good movie.
Yeah.
So I am shocked that this franchise still has legs under it enough to produce a 95% rating on Harry Potter. I thought the world moved past Harry Potter by now.
Which you'd think, right? It's been, I believe, what, 2, 3, maybe even 4 years since the final book in the series came out. And I'll admit, I read all of them, and I actually really enjoyed most of the book series. But I would have a similar, I guess, feeling to you. Though, even though I've seen all the movies thus far, I think past the first one, which I thought did a great job of capturing the the imagination and magic of this world, especially with that score by John Williams, which I think is probably one of his best scores of sort of his, I guess, later post-Star Wars, post-Indiana Jones composing career.
True, which, as a odd side note trivia, I was there's a movie out on in the other room from where I was working the other day, and I can hear the sound through my office. I noted that there are very distinct notes from Home Alone's soundtrack in Harry Potter's soundtrack.
John Williams will definitely take some of his own stuff. Can't blame him for that, but it's,
if it works,
it's,
keep selling it.
It really is quite interesting that I have gotten sort of the sense that the Harry Potter films have sort of been getting kind of mundane as they've gone on. I thought Prisoner of Azkaban was actually kind of interesting because they basically got a very avant-garde director, Alfonso Cuarón, who's done a very popular independent film called Y Tu Mama Tambien, and he did the kind of independent sci-fi film Children of Men. And that actually put sort of an interesting flair on Prisoner of Azkaban, plus that got actually John Williams to come back and do another original score, which I thought was quite well done. But since then, they almost feel like, you know, like Jurassic Park 3, like adding more stuff on, and you just don't really care. Like it's not terrible, but it's just not something you remember past a few moments that when you've sort of left the theater. But apparently this one is just, I guess, that much better. It should be tempered a bit with the fact that the other Harry Potter films, I think, have all done decently well. I don't think there's ever been a Harry Potter film that's made below a 70% on the Rotten Tomato meter.
Yeah, I actually have it pulled up here in front of me. So the overall Rotten Tomatoes meters since the first film has been 78%, 82%, 89%, 89%, 77%, and now it looks like going out for a 95%.
Yeah, so... So, I mean, there's. I guess it should be taken with a grain of salt, the fact that it's getting such high praise. It may just be a good movie, but not... And everyone agrees it's a good movie, but just not a great movie. And that's always the, I guess, the problem with Rotten Tomatoes. It tells you how many people thought it was better than fail, but not necessarily
good. This may be actually a more interesting than perspective, is that the top critics, so that special tier of critics on Rotten Tomatoes that I suppose has some amount more of maybe trustability... Sure. Their ratings have been 74%, 70%, 90% for Prisoner of Azkaban, then 89%, 69%, and then now 96%.
Interesting.
So a big swing from the Order of Phoenix to the Half-Blood Prince.
So in either case, it looks like this next Harry Potter movie could actually be, I'm hoping it will be sort of bringing out of the sort of rut that the Harry Potter films have been in for a while. Maybe it'll make a bit more of an impression. I'm not super hopeful since it's done by the same director who did the last film, The Order of the Phoenix. And I thought, again, it was okay, but not spectacular. But either way, it's definitely made me far more excited to see this movie, just to see that the critical community as a whole generally thinks this is a pretty darn good movie.
Yeah, so this is a movie that I was obviously planning to see so we could chat about it. But before it was going to kind of be great, I have to go see another Harry Potter movie. But with this news, I actually may have a little more interest in paying attention.
Well, but either way, that's what we'll bring you guys with the next review for next Weekly Monotony. But before we do that, let's end out with my last movie story, which is the District 9 full-length movie trailer came out last week on yahoo.com. I believe it will be in front of a movie coming up soon, but I'm not sure anyone quite knows what it's going to be. But this is something I put on one of my trailers I think a new trailer Friday a while back. District 9 is a movie done by Neil Blomkamp, who is he's basically an unknown director. He's done a couple commercials. The reason why his name is familiar at all to anyone is that he was tapped to do the Halo movie, the one sponsored by Peter Jackson and Weta a while back, until that movie fell apart because basically the production or the producers kind of started dragging their heels, and I think the production company started dragging their heels. This was a new guy. He had never done a feature film before, and they were about to give him this huge, huge license.
Right.
So either way, so Blomkamp didn't get a chance to do that. He did do a couple small shorts, commercials shorts for Halo 3 that were met with sort of mixed reviews. But now he's getting a chance to do his first full-length movie, also sponsored by Peter Jackson, also sponsored by Weta, the Peter Jackson's effects shop. It's basically the story of an alien race that comes to Johannesburg in South Africa and kind of sets up shop there, but not in the normal sense that the aliens have come to invade or they've come to bring us enlightenment. They basically are just there, and for some reason the government around there won't let them leave, and we don't quite know why. There's sort of a mystery built in this concept of why are these aliens here, why won't the government let them leave, and they get put in these almost slum areas or almost ghetto areas this ghetto area called District 9, which is basically where all these kind of poor aliens are placed, even though they have this crazy technology, which is clearly more advanced than ours. For some reason, they can't leave themselves, and we're not letting them leave. And that's kind of the mystery and the story based around this. And it's actually based on a short film that Neil Blomkamp did called Alive in Joburg. In fact, this movie looks almost a direct adaptation of that short film. But Todd, you got a chance to see this trailer. What did you think of just of the concept itself? Did you find it exciting?
I find the concept very interesting for at least two reasons. One, it's not set in USA. Yep. So finally an alien movie where the aliens decided not to land in the US.
Not to blow up New York.
lends a little bit of credibility to it. You know, it's like we've seen enough aliens come to America.
Right.
Second reason I find this interesting is partly because of the style. I mean, the style is a very interesting sort of, again, documentary style, very much similar, at least in the trailer, to what we saw when he did those Halo 3 shorts. And the premise, I guess there's 3 points here, and the premise is very unique. I mean, what other alien movie, I can't think of any in recent history. I mean, we could maybe say The Day the Earth Stood Still in a very weird kind of corollary way.
Possibly, yeah.
Was a similar premise where the aliens didn't come to take over the world. But I can't think of another alien movie in recent memory, mainstream at least, where aliens have come and the premise has not come to fight humans and humans have to rally to fight back. So I'm very curious to see how they weave this story. And from what I've seen in the trailer, it looks to be done in a very nice way, not really cheesy. So actually, I'm pretty interested in learning more about this. The mystery around this movie and the trailer have really got me intrigued, more so than a lot of other movies have managed to do.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've seen the other things. They've done more than just the full movie trailer, and then maybe they did this before. They've got this sort of alternate reality thing going with it as well.
Sure,
where they,
right.
And I think I saw this actually run on TV, where they run this commercial for this movie where it addresses you as if it's a real news message, like addressing citizens of the world, you know, please stay out of District 9, District 9, blah, blah, blah. Like a very real, like, this is a real news alert.
Right.
And only at the very end do they say rated R, you know, this is a movie.
Right.
So they're kind of taking a very different approach to even marketing this movie out to the public. So I'm really curious by all these changes from what we expect from a Hollywood movie.
See, I'm so excited about this film because it really does feel like it blends together some of the best concepts of alien science fiction into a new way that we've never seen it. Like it takes one of my favorite movies, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where you have aliens which are not directly hostile, you know, which I think is probably one of the few movies that have ever really done that. Maybe E.T. would be sort of the next one, where it's basically non-hostile aliens, not here to kill us all. Takes that and sort of mixes it in with a modern re-envisioning of War of the Worlds, the old radio broadcast, which was done in this concept of, you know, radio televised addresses in a very new style of that time, which, of course, you know, caused people to freak out and, you know, small riots to pop up because people were scared. And this takes that concept only rather than being, you know, radio address, it's almost like CNN news footage. And I you know, every time I watch the trailer, when I first saw this trailer, or at least the original teaser in front of, I believe it was Wolverine, I just got goosebumps, like, seeing this footage of this, you know, this very almost Independence Day looking ship, only one that looks kind of clunky and, like, pieced together over this African town, and something about it, I don't know, just gave me the goosebumps. I really am looking forward to see this movie.
And I think one of the things that makes this really unique, I just remembered, and I've seen it again here on their website, what they ran on the commercial, which really lended this what? You know, like, what is this trailer? Right. Or what is this going on? Is that they actually give you a phone number to call to report non-humans. So they say, if you see non-humans, report them to, and they give you an 800 number, 866-666-6001.
Well, that's cool.
Something of a unique number there as well. Right. So they're really extending the idea of making this feel as real as possible.
Yeah, so I definitely love the direction they're going. I watched Neil Blomkamp's original short. I thought, even though it was clearly done on a very low production budget, I thought it looked really cool. Seeing this new trailer, which is the first time we actually get to see a bit more of the aliens, a bit more of their technology and these kind of robotic suits they have, I will admit that there's one thing that kind of worries me a little bit, and this is something, somewhat of a criticism I had of the original Halo 3 shorts that he did, is it almost feels like the CG in this is done a little too lo-fi, almost to the point where it feels a little bit like, oh, that's obviously CG being placed in this environment. Like, it feels like independent level CG and not Weta level CG.
It's funny you point that out, because I just rewatched the trailer just minutes ago while we were chatting. Right. And that's one thing that distinctly stood out to me, is the CG looked clearly composited in, almost to the point where I was like, oh, wow, they really need to clean that up for the movie. So I do hope that maybe it's just something that we're seeing in the trailers. Maybe it's just, you know, weird frames they picked out. Right. But certainly it would be a bummer for a movie that has so much promise to sort of take you out of the experience with sci-fi channel quality CG.
Yeah, that's a very good way to talk about it. It is kind of very sci-fi channel CG. Hopefully, maybe we're just not seeing enough of it to appreciate it. We've definitely only seen very quick clips of it. And at least in the teaser, the stuff they showed of the alien spaceship and the alien being interrogated all looked top-notch. So,
yeah, now that part was cool. So the cool thing is August 14th, we get to know. Comes out in theaters, I assume, everywhere. So not too long from now.
Yeah, so and I guess the last thing I want to tack on is, I'm not sure how strong of an opinion you'll have on this, but do you think if District 9 does well, we might see him tapped again for the Halo 3 movie?
I don't know. I have yet to see any of these sort of in the works, they're working on making this video game a movie, things actually come to light. I mean, maybe you can think of one I'm not thinking of, but all these projects I hear have talked about, oh, Hollywood's picked up the script for
like,
this. We're going to make
like
a movie
BioShock
out of it.
Like BioShock and other things like that.
Like BioShock. Yeah, all these big games have been so successful in the gaming world and supposedly have these Hollywood deals in the works. I've yet to see anything come from those. So I'm doubtful still that a video game can be well translated or that a studio is ready to take the risk on translating a video game into a big budget movie. So I, even if this does well, I don't necessarily see this leading to Halo 3 the movie.
Interesting.
Or Halo the movie.
I actually, to some degree, I feel like this is sort of the testing grounds. This is the chance for studios to test the waters a bit with Neil Blomkamp to see whether he can produce a film that can pull in a big box office take, or at least a decent enough box office take for an unknown franchise. And maybe if he does well with this, like, they'll take the training wheels off and maybe reconsider the Halo movie in the future. Because I know for a while the Halo movie was definitely, you know, up on its feet, raring to go. They had a script written by a guy who wrote some scripts for some other really good sci-fi movies. Don't remember his name at the moment. But I mean, it did have legs for a while until the studios backed down from what I'm almost sure was Neil Blomkamp, the untested director, being given the helm for this movie.
Sure. So, that said, though, and just a little into the future, if this movie plays out well, and we've said here a few times that the style of this movie very much resembles the style of the Halo shorts,
yep,
I'd be extra fearful that a Halo movie would just feel like District 9 repackaged with Halo story and characters, as in, is he a one-trick pony director?
It's quite possible. Basically, we haven't seen Neil Blomkamp be able to show us...
I was about to say, we're reading a lot into it for not having actually seen more than 2 minutes of the movie.
And I've seen some of Neil Blomkamp's stuff, and I've watched a lot of his shorts, and he does really have one kind of style he goes toward, this kind of gritty shot with a handy cam look with effects placed into it. So, we'll see if he can transition from that to, I think, what we all first imagined when we heard Peter Jackson and Weta attached to a Halo movie, which was Lord of the Rings in space. So,
sure. Can't argue with that.
All right. Well, I think that just about wraps it up for this news-centric version of Weekly Monotony. We hope you enjoyed some of our ramblings and some of our conversations. As always, come back to dailymonotony.com as often as you can to read up on the latest, most interesting bits of movie and game news, as well as movie reviews and game reviews as often as I can get them up to you, the wonderful internet public. And until next time, this is Dustin Englund, signing off.